हरिः कृष्ण हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
At 50, a man is supposed to retire from his family activities, and this stage is called Vanaprastha. In the Vanaprastha ashram, both man and wife agree to abstain from further sexual contact. They may continue living together, but the emphasis is on spiritual partnership. As Vanaprasthas, they may travel together on pilgrimage to the holy places in India, preparing for their inevitable departure from the material world. Thus, the Vedic ashramas, after allowing one to fulfill material life, enable one to end the cycle of repeated birth and death and attain the eternal spiritual world. A man of 50 should be able to see by his aging body that inevitable death is approaching, and he should have the good sense to prepare. In the final division, the sannyasa ashram, the man places his wife in the care of a grown son and fully dedicates himself to serving the Supreme Lord. Formerly, the sannyasa ashram meant a solitary life of penances in the Himalayas. But in the Gaudiya Vaishnav line, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had emphasized preaching. Although Abhay had not formally defined his status within the four ashrams, he appeared to be living more as a vanaprastha than a grihastha. He saw his business failures and his distasteful family situation as Krishna's blessings, freeing him from family responsibilities and turning him wholeheartedly towards executing Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's order to preach. See, now you're looking at it, whatever is your ultimate goal, that's then what you'll see as, if you have a goal, you don't mind going through the trouble it takes to get to it. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So, if your goal is to go back to Godhead, then the difficulties that are there in material life, if that's part of the process, it's not really a problem. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yes? No? So, that's why then this process is designed how it is. It's understood that material life, only lasts so long. When one's younger, one studies like that, one endeavors in so many ways according to plans they have for their life. But as one gets older, then it says here from 50, then one starts to look at it very seriously that, now one should look at, what's going to happen at the end, right? Where are you going to go? So then that makes all these seeming difficulties not a problem. But now if your goal is simply to be happy in the material world, then this process doesn't look very attractive, right? Because why should you give up? Means one will try to be happy in the material world by engaging in material activities. No? So now if those activities that are the source of your happiness are given up, that doesn't sound very attractive, right? No. But the problem is even if you do count them as your source of happiness, as you get older, they don't work so good, right? The senses don't work so good. One doesn't have the same sharpness in one's memory. One doesn't have the same coordination and balance. One gets sick more easily, one gets fatigued more easily, tired more easily. So then that process definitely isn't working anyway, right? So it's not actually an option. So the option means, therefore, one has to make the plan. The ultimate goal is beyond this life, beyond this body. Does that make sense? Yeah? So that kind of thing then has to be established. Yes? No? Yeah. So that has to be established. So therefore, this process is there. Right? One spends the first part of the life studying in that, focusing on that, developing the knowledge and qualities required to be successful in life, right? The second stage then in the Grihastha ashram, then one is engaging, you know, in whatever variety of activities that one thinks is actually important to them, right? But seeing how to, you know, try to connect everything to Krishna, how to get everything connected to Krishna. Right. Then the third stage, then what it's talked about here, the vanaprastha stage, you start to then switch from engaging in all kinds of activities and the family life being the prominent to back to the spiritual being the prominent. Right? It doesn't mean that one's not interactive with family members and that, but that interaction isn't the specific goal. It is being done nicely and everything, but one has other interests, right? And then the last stage, then the sannyasashram, that means then one is firmly just only fixed, just like the brahmachari, in performing the spiritual activities. There's not other interests like that. Does this make sense?
Yes.
Like that. But the point is from the vanaprastha ashram or the sannyasashram, both of those are considered very safe, right? Because one's absorption's not in the material energy. Right, the focus is on the spiritual, so that's considered safe. Right, or the brahmachari ashram. Grihastha is not the ideal ashram to leave one's body in. Does that make sense? Like that. But as we see, is that these things, they have their external form, but more important is their mentality. So it's a mentality of being trained, mentality of using what you've been trained in a variety of ways. Then third stage is the mentality of pulling oneself out of the focus that the engagement in all varieties of activities in this world is what's important. And then the fourth stage is just completely not being interested in, you know, what's going on here. You know, it can go nice, it can go not nice, it doesn't matter. Does that make sense? That kind of a thing. So that can be, of course, obtained by anybody, but it works much, much nicer. You know, the forms of it make it work very well. You know what I'm saying? You know, like you could cook a sabji in any pot, but there's certain pots that work best for cooking that particular kind of sabji. Right? Does that make sense? Right? It means, let's say something like spinach, right? You boil it. But you could cook it in a wok, I mean a karai, right? Like that. Let's say same time as a chachari that you would want to be cooking in a karai, you could cook it in a regular pot. You know, it works, it's just not as ideal. So the form is to see that what you want gets done in the nicest way. But if not, if the mentality is there, the understanding is there, then it can still be obtained. You know what you're doing, you know how to cook, then whatever pot you have, you'll get it done. Right? That makes sense. You've all heard of, just as a perfect example, I think I've explained to you the recipe of pasta labusta. You've all heard this? No. You haven't heard pasta labusta? I think a busta is a bag, right? A sack. Huh? A bosta. Okay, so it's a sack, right? So you have pasta, right? Okay, so now what you have is pasta and you have bags. So this was the recipe for some of the Gurukul graduates when they were working in the offices over in the temple. So you have a plastic bag, right? You know, it's got the two little handles on it. So you fill it up with water and you put it down very nicely so that the handles are sitting there nice, right? Then from, you know, ideally a new broom, but, you know, whatever. Then the coconut brooms, not the full jaru, the nautical, the hard broom, right? you break off one of those little, you know, strands there. Then you very carefully stick it through the bag, right? The handles on the bag, right? You put it through there. Then you take one of those little hot water heaters, you know, that are meant for heating up like a small glass of water or something like that, those things. And you hang that very carefully on that coconut thing, right? Then you plug it in, right? Then you put the pasta in the bag, right? Or you could put the pasta in the bag first, whatever it is, you know, so it's in the bag with the water, right? Then, how do you say? Yeah. Then you plug it in and that will heat up and eventually it will cook the pasta. Right? Does that make sense? But you have to make sure that the plastic, the heating element does not touch the side of the bag, otherwise you'll have problem. Right? Then you have a tiffin, right? You know, tiffin with the handle on it and all that. So in there, you can do this before or after. It's probably better to do before, so it's there. Is you put your little boiling element in there, you know, with your tomatoes or spice or anything else that you want to make your sauce, right? So after you've cooked that, then you can, you know, then boil the pasta. Then when the pasta's boiled, then, you know, you turn off the electric element, remove the, you know, stuff from the bag. Then carefully pour the water out of the bag. Leave the pasta in the bag. Pour the water out of the bag. Then from the tiffin, you take that sauce that you've made and pour that into the bag also. Right? And then, you know, nicely holding the handles, you shake it around a bit, mix it up like that, and then you roll down the edges and that, and then you have lunch. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. I'm not joking. This is what they used to do every day. Okay. So, it proves the point that if you know cooking, then no matter what the situation, you can cook, no matter what your paraphernalia. But you wouldn't actually say that this would be ideal, no? But it'll work, you understand? So that's the principle, is that if you understand the mood of something, you understand the technique of it, the science of it, then you can always apply it. Even though it may be more difficult, you have to be more careful, all these different things, it has to work. Does that make sense? Right. So that's why in the training, the most important is the knowledge and attitude that go with something. Then the form, you know the ideal form, and you try to get as close as possible. Right? That makes sense? Yeah. Okay. Yes? So that means if you had to cook a lot of pasta, then you could probably do it in a bathtub. Right? So, you know, like that. Any questions on this? Okay. What kind of bag to use? Okay. In Allahabad, Abai managed to save enough money to revive printing back to Godhead. And in February 1952, from his editorial office and home, at 57B Canning Road, the first issue in 8 years appeared. As before, he did everything himself. All the writing, typing, editing, meeting with the printer, and finally distributing the copies by hand, as well as mailing them to respectable leaders throughout India. Thus, he felt, was the real purpose of living in Allahabad. Or anywhere. This was the best use of money, the purpose of human life, to engage fully in glorifying the Supreme Lord. Other things were temporary and would soon be lost. So it seems he was printing from Allahabad. When he visited his family in Calcutta, old friends would gather in his room, and he would preach and give classes on Bhagavad Gita. Abai invited his wife and family to take part in these discussions, but they would resolutely sit in an upstairs room, often taking tea, as if in defiance of his preaching. Right? So, you know, it makes it a little difficult to be, how you say, inspired about family life, you know. Abai was supporting them He was still associating with them, but he was bent on preaching, and they were not making it attractive for him to do so within the family. If there were to be family life for Abai, then his wife and sons would have to recognize and rejoice in the fact that he was becoming a full-fledged preacher. They would have to understand that his life's concern was to serve his spiritual master's mission. They could not simply ignore his transformation. They could not insist that he was simply an ordinary man. Abai continued to try to draw his wife in, hoping she would gradually follow him in the preacher's life. But she had not the slightest interest in her husband's preaching. And why should he spend his days worrying about family, chemicals, and money? Let his relatives criticize. But back to Godhead was the real service he could offer to the whole family of mankind. Madhavendra Puri, a great spiritual master and preceptor of Lord Chaitanya, had written about the devotee's indifference to worldly criticism. Right? Because indifference, that's actually the position of sannyas, because there's nothing to interact with. Right? Interact, don't interact, but there's no specific interest in it. Does that make sense? Someone can either like something very much or not like something, but the topic's the same. The topic itself is what's important. Right? Does that make sense? Yes? No? So, but indifference means the topic's not important. Right? So, indifference means you can work with it, not work with it, but it's not important. Right? But if you like something very much or don't like the same thing very much, it still means that thing that you either like or dislike, that's the most important thing. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's why indifference, that's the principle of sannyas. Right? Is that it's not that you don't care, meaning it's a negative, it just doesn't matter if it's nice, not nice. If prasad's nice, great. If it's not nice, it doesn't matter. Because the point is not eating, the point is just serving Krishna. Does that make sense? But if the prasad has to be nice or the prasad shouldn't be nice, you know, then that means the prasad means it's more important. Right? Does that make sense? O demigods and forefathers, this is Madhavendra Puri, please excuse me. I am unable to perform any more offerings for your pleasure. Now I have decided to free myself from all reactions to sins, simply by remembering anywhere and everywhere the great descendant of Yadu and the great enemy of Kamsa, Lord Krishna. I think that this is sufficient for me. So what is the use of further endeavors? Let the sharp moralist accuse me of being illusioned. I do not mind. Experts in Vedic activities may slander me as being misled. Friends and relatives may call me frustrated. My brothers may call me a fool. And wealthy Mammonites may point me out as mad. And the learned philosophers may assert that I am much too proud. Still, my mind does not budge an inch from the determination to serve the lotus feet of Govinda, though I be unable to do it. So therefore, it's understood, all those points, that people will criticize. You take it up fully, just absorb yourself in Krishna consciousness, and this is what people will say. It's just the way it is. But because that's our goal, what do we care, right? If you're absorbed in business, people are going to complain anyway, right? But you don't care because you want the business to work. Right? So whatever you want to work, you don't care who criticizes, right? Right, isn't it? So that principle then Madhavendra Puri is making is that if we want to absorb ourselves in Krishna, what do we care what anybody else thinks? What do we care whatever anybody else feels? Right? Yes? No? Why should he waste time with petty family problems when he held answers to the problems of India and the world? Right? Not that that's not important. It should be understood from this. It doesn't mean that just because you have the answers to the world problems doesn't mean that you can't solve the problems of family life. It's not that they're too small. Nothing's too small. But the point is his family is not wanting any answers to their problems. You know what I'm saying? The family's not interested. He has the answers. They're not interested. They don't want to know actually how to become happy. They have their own idea. They just have some money, and then they sit around and do nothing. Right? So that's not very progressive, either materially or spiritually. So they want no answers. But it's not that Prabhupada couldn't give answers to the family and to the world. He can do all of that. Right? But some may mistake that, oh yeah, we don't have to worry about family. If I'm preaching, I don't have to worry about family. But the point is, the family's supportive, they're Krishna conscious, why one wouldn't worry? They're devotees. You're preaching to make people devotees, the family's already devotees. So does that mean the people, when you preach to them, once they become devotees, you won't care for them anymore? If you're going to care for them, why wouldn't you care for the family who's devotees? Right? Does that make sense? But in this case, then the family doesn't care, doesn't respond. So he's being dutiful. He takes care of things, but he has no interest. Does this make sense? Yeah? No? Maybe? Not sure? You sure or not sure? Yes. Okay, very good. As a knower of Bhagavad Gita, he felt that his first obligation was to offer solutions to the complex crisis of war, hunger, immorality, crime, all symptoms of godlessness. And if dedicating himself to such work meant that other, lesser responsibilities suffered, then there was no loss. Right? Does that make sense? So there's the balance. There's these lesser ones, because if they're devotees, then it's not a lesser point. It's just another point. A sense is simply just material facility. Then it is a lesser point. Right? Establishing God consciousness is the superior point. So the family wants to be God conscious, then helping them do that is another part of his activities. Does that make sense? Yes? In March 1952, Abai published another issue of Back to Godhead. That was in February 52. Okay. Wow. 1 month later. It was dedicated mostly to a biographical article Abai had written about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and his father, Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur. And from the magazine. He, Bhaktivinod Thakur, vehemently protested against the principles of those pseudo-transcendentalists now passing in the name of Lord Chaitanya. He initiated the reformatory movement by literary contributions while he still engaged as a high government officer. During his householder life and serving as a magistrate, he wrote books of various descriptions in Bengali, English, Sanskrit, and etc., to present an actual picture of pure devotional activities to Lord Chaitanya. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj got inspiration from his very childhood, all about Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur's movement. He worked as the private secretary as Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur, and as such, Bhaktivinod Thakur gave him Srila Saraswati Thakur the transcendental power of attorney to espouse the cause of Lord Chaitanya. And so after Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur's departure, Srila Saraswati Thakur took up reins of that reformatory movement. Right? So you're saying Bhaktivinod Thakur, that he was very strong on preaching against non-devotional elements within Lord Chaitanya's movement, those who passed as you know, transcendentalists but who are not. And so he did this by writing books and preaching. But he did all that still as a householder and a magistrate. Right? So a very big responsibility. It wasn't, he had a small family. I think he had 12 kids, you know, like that. So had a large family. He was a magistrate. So that means, you know, he's the local judge. So he would adjudicate all cases. He would sit in Krishnagar. So that means all the district cases would come to him. And he would deal with that. And he would write books. Right? So he would do all that. So then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, then he was Bhaktivinoda Thakur's secretary. And so in that, by that association, by hearing and all that, then he learned the same method. And then after Bhaktivinoda Thakur, after his departure, then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, then he carried on that same drive of the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Yes?
Yes.
No? What do you think? Yes. So, what was he driving? Sumo ambassador? Jaguar? He was driving a Jaguar. Well, he didn't drive it. Someone else drove it for him. So what was he driving? A stake into the ground? Huh? A horse? Cows? What was he driving? A dragon. Yeah? What is this dragon? Huh? So he's driving forward the mission of Lord Chaitanya. Okay? Yeah? Absorbed in his producing his monthly journal, Abhay went about his other activities only superficially. Sometimes he traveled on business or, taking the night train from Allahabad to Calcutta, visited his family. When his compartment was not crowded, he would turn on a light while others slept. Riding a night train provided a good opportunity to think or even write. Sometimes he would sleep for a few hours, then sit up again and look out the window, to see only night and the reflected lights of the train compartment shining back at him, the windows reflecting his face. Halfway through the 12-hour journey, the sky would lighten, turn gray from gray to light blue, and the first white clouds would appear in the sky. He could see lights in the towns and hear the train horn warning. Then the train slowed and stopped at a station. When the train slowed and stopped at a station, tea vendors would walk alongside the train, train windows yelling, chai, chai, chai. Yes. At least they didn't have special chai then. Their loud sing-song din filling the ears with chai, and chai filling the air with its aroma as hundreds of passengers sipped their morning tea. During this more than 20 years of extensive train travel, Abhay had noticed more and more people smoking cigarettes and more women traveling alone. India was becoming westernized, and the national leaders were paving the way, the blind leading the blind. They wanted the kingdom of God without God. They wanted a progressive, industrialized India without Krishna. From the windows, he could see large fields being left uncultivated, and yet people were hungry. Abhay would sometimes read a newspaper. In other words, the whole thing before, the whole drive was, Swaraj was to follow Indian culture, that the British were creating an obstacle to following Indian culture. So the idea was kick out the British, then under India's self-rule, then they could nicely follow their natural culture. But instead of doing that, they kicked out the British, but kept the British culture, right? And so then they tried to industrialize and everything. That was technically actually Nehru, right? Because Gandhi wanted, the cottage industries, everything based on village life. But Nehru wanted to industrialize. He felt that's the only way India is going to get ahead. But they didn't talk about this before, because it wasn't that it was Gandhi's idea so much the independence. He was just wanting, people to have, proper, to be dealt with properly, fairly. And so the people in India, they had this political idea to free themselves from Indian rule. But if you present it just as that, as political, what do people care? Who's in charge? It doesn't matter. But if you make it sound like it's some cultural thing, then people get inspired. So hearing about Gandhi's work, they invited him to India and showed him around India. One, so he could see, the culture and everything, because he was Indian, but he was from South Africa. Right? So he had grown up there, gone to school in England, like that. He became a lawyer. Then they brought him back so he could see his roots in India, see the culture, and also see how the British are making so much problem. He could see there's problem in SA, so he could also see that there's problem in India. So they're saying, therefore we should free ourselves from this. So he's looking at it from the point of actually establishing the culture, establishing the religion. But they were looking at it politically. But they didn't have the power to draw so many people into that program. So in other words, there were some intellectual students who are worried about this, right? You could see when Prabhupada was young, then some students, just that, individuals, but it wasn't a very big movement. So they inspired Gandhi, who had become very famous, and he was able to inspire all the people. So they therefore supported him, because one, they did, because he could get all the people and get the independence. But they didn't actually support his ideas. But they would make it appear as if they did. Right? But their motives were purely political. None of these other people were religious really at all, right? Especially Nehru. Right? Then having gotten the independence, when they see immediately, then it started in a different direction. It's not that they were going in Gandhi's direction and then slowly it changed. No, they weren't interested in Gandhi's direction. Right? All they were interested in is that he could rally the people so they could have a revolution. That's all. That make sense? Yes? No? Doesn't make sense? Makes sense. Yes, it doesn't make sense, or yes, it makes sense? Okay. Just have to make sure. Abai would sometimes read a newspaper and cut out an article that seemed to warrant a reply in Back to Godhead, or that sparked an idea for an essay, right? So Prabhupada was always up to date. He was reading the paper, but from that he would get ideas for preaching. He would understand what is the present mentality and how to preach, right? So like that. So he'd read the paper because there was something in there that could be used in that way. So it wasn't that he wasn't up to date, right? He was always up to date. He would deliberate over how to approach people for assistance, whom to approach, and how to start a society of Krishna-conscious devotees. People not only in India, but all over the world, could take to Krishna consciousness. The Chaitanya Bhagavat had predicted that the name of Lord Chaitanya would one day be known in every town and village. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had wanted that. He had sent preachers to England, but they had only gained a protocol visit with the royalty, stood in line, bowed before the crown, and then come back to India without effecting any change in the Western people. Abai thought about sending Back to Godhead abroad. His agents, Thacker, Spink, and company, had contacts in America and Europe. People read English all over the world, and some of them would surely appreciate the ideas from Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. This is what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had wanted. Krishna consciousness was not for India alone. It was India's greatest gift, and it was for everyone. Yeah, so others had gone to the West to preach, but all they had done is, you know, met with the queen, means, you know, got in line with everybody else, bowed, maybe gave her a book or something, said something, left. They didn't actually preach. You know what I'm saying? They weren't able to spend much time like that. In fact, they're in England, but they had to be supported from India. Money had to be sent from India to England to, you know, pay their rent and maintain them. They weren't able to figure out there how to actually generate anything. So, yeah. So Prabhupada's order was to preach in the West, preach through the English language. So therefore, he's thinking, we can establish this. We can send the books around the world. We can get people interested. Okay, that was Chapter 7. Jhansi, the League of Devotees. Quote, wanted candidates from any nationality to qualify themselves as real Brahmins for preaching the teachings of Bhagavad Gita for all practical purposes throughout the whole world. Deserving candidates will be provided with free boarding and lodging. Apply, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, founder and secretary of the League of Devotees, Bharati Bhavan, P.O., Jhansi, U.P. That's Abai Charan Day. So this was Prabhupada's ad for making devotees. He wanted people to come forward. Right? So this shows what it is. Anybody from anywhere, we're looking for those who want to qualify themselves as Brahmins, who want to learn the Brahminical culture, how to live it, how to apply it in your life, because they can then give train everybody, the rest of the world, in this culture. It was another 12-hour ride with dozens of stops. The train's rattling and clattering and its rocking from side to side made riding difficult. But Abai, crowded on the wooden bench with other third-class passengers, kept riding. Within the dingy compartment, passengers eyed one another complacently, and soot and dust blew in the open window as the train sped along. Why would soot and dust blow in the window? Yeah, there were coal engines there. Like now you have these electric engines or diesel, but before they were coal. And it's true, if you sat next to the window, you'd have all these little dinky pieces of coal, very small, all over your clothes and everything. Like that. You remember that? You ever rode on the choo-choos?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I'm not in Europe, I rode on
the... But they did the same thing? Little bits of coal would come flying in the window. Yeah, yeah, if the wind is blowing, yeah. But here in India, they retired them, I think, I'm not sure when, and maybe in the 80s. But in the 70s, and so many of the trains were all, you know, like the Tufan Express, that was definitely a coal train.
Many of them were faster than the diesel ones.
Oh, yeah? I don't know about the Tufan, but, like that. Within the outside, past the monotonous embankment of loose stones, bright violet trumpet flowers bloomed on tall stalks in the shallow trackside ditches. Water buffalo and oxen grazed in the distance, or sometimes pulled a plow before a solitary farmer. Abai was going to Jhansi, not for business, but for preaching. 1 month before, in October of 1952, when Abai had visited Jhansi on business, Mr. Dubey, a customer and the owner of a Jhansi hospital, had invited him to lecture at the Gita Mandir. Many Jhansi people appreciated things religious or humanitarian, whether from Vaishnavs, Theosophists, Mayavadis, politicians, or whatever. They regarded almost any path as dharma as long as it showed some edifying piety or tended towards the public welfare. Right? See, as most will consider, it's nice if it shows some morality, care for others, concern for others, you know, benefit for others, then they'll consider this is very nice. And generally that'll be called spiritual because material is taken as, you know, completely self-centered. You know, you're self-centered, you're only into your own thing, you're only into your own life, your own possessions, your own family. So anything beyond that, that's considered spiritual, right? Because that's kind of the opposite. But humanitarian, these are just extended. What you want for yourself, you want for others, but it's still material. You want material facility, but you want to see it for others. So you're a nicer person, you're pious, right? But it doesn't mean it's spiritual. Spiritual means it's actually on the transcendental platform. It deals with the soul, right? Not with just material facilities for the body. Mr. Dubey had read with interest several issues of Back to Godhead and had therefore requested Abai to speak. Abai had been eager, and he had found keen interest among the audience of more than 100 people, many of them young medical students and graduates from the local Ayurvedic college. Abai was 56, and his commanding presentation of Krishna consciousness had impressed the young religious-minded people of Jhansi. 25-year-old Prabhakar Misra, principal of the Vedanta Sanskrit College and head medical officer of the Jhansi Ayurvedic College, saw that Abai was very forceful in his desire to spread Krishna consciousness. Dr. Misra regarded him as a kind of guru, although dressed in white. Quote, here is a humble person, he thought, a real sadhu. Notice it's interesting here is that when Prabhakar Misra is a Brahminical title, you know, like Jagannath Misra, Lord Chaitanya's family line. Like that, but he was the principal of the Sanskrit college and the head medical officer at the Ayurvedic University at 25. Right? So that's the Vedic principle, is when someone's qualified, you don't worry about age. Like that. If they're qualified, then they're doing it. You know, if they're not qualified, then it doesn't matter what age they are, you don't give it to them. Right? Does that make sense? So within education, within the Brahminical fields of knowledge, education, your Ayurvedas, it's not age that's important. What's important is that knowledge and ability to apply it. Yes? Question? No. Short and stocky, Dr. Shastri, just beginning his career in Ayurvedic medicine, was an active young man, fascinated by Abai's purity and his vision of a world movement for distributing India's culture. Older men like tall, suave Ramachandran Haiharan Mitra, a utensils shopkeeper who wrote poetry and wore a white Nehru cap, also wanted to learn more about Lord Chaitanya from Abhai. Right? The Nehru cap, it was made out of this. This is how they made it look like they were worried about cotton industries. They wear this khadi cloth. Khadi cloth meant that the threads were hand-spun, and then it was hand-woven, right? Handloom cloth means that it's machine-spun threads, but hand-woven. And then mill cloth means it's machine-spun threads and machine-made, machine-woven. Okay, so you wear this hand-spun, hand-woven cloth. So they had this little hat that they would wear. You know, it was somehow, and I'm not sure what it would be taken from, but it was kind of like, it's flat, so it's pointed on both ends, and it's a little wider in the middle, and it's just a little, you know, something tall. You'd wear it over the top like that. And so it was made out of khadi, and they'd wear khadi shirts and khadi pants. So, or khadi dhotis, and that way then they looked very khadi-ish, right? So, supposedly very much supporting the Gandhian, you know, movement of self-sufficiency and everything, you know, nice like that. But they actually didn't really care. It's just something that they do. Even today, I think politicians still tend to wear khadi, you know, a little bit more old-fashioned ones. They wear khadi. So the Nehru hat meant you were, you know, be Indian, buy Indian, you know, all these different kinds of things. Dr. Mullock, who was the Gita Mandir secretary, and Dr. Siddhi from the university, along with their wives, had sincerely approached Abhay after his talk and asked him to please to visit Jhansi again. Abhay had come to them not as a pharmaceutical salesman or as a man with family concerns, but purely as a devotee of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Although the specific applications of Krishna consciousness, as given by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, were new to his audience, these teachings had interested them, and the more Abhay had expressed these teachings and spoken of his ambitions for spreading Krishna's message, the more his hearers had encouraged him. Several of them had suggested he conduct his mission in Jhansi, and they had promised to help him. Dr. Shastri had even invited Abhay to come live with him. He would introduce Abhay to important citizens and arrange for lectures in the various meeting places of Jhansi. After staying for 10 days, Abhay had returned to Allahabad. But remembering Jhansi, he had been unable to concentrate on his business. Something more important was on his mind: the need for an association of devotees propagating the teachings and practices of Krishna consciousness worldwide. With the Gaudiya Math now broken into permanent schisms, right? You know, it's still permanent schisms. His godbrothers conducting their own private ashrams in separate locales, apparently impervious to any reconciliations. Something would have to be done if the overwhelming atmosphere of godlessness were to be corrected. There must emerge, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had envisioned, a league of preachers with activities worldwide. The nations of the world had sought unity through the League of Nations, and recently through the United Nations, right? After World War I, because it was such a big fight, you know, all the whole world. Those don't have a bag? So they got together and said, we should not have a war like this again. So they made the League of Nations, right? League is, you know, all these people who are getting together, you know, like an association. And like this, then they all sat around and I guess, you know, discussed this and that, and then World War II happened. So then it was understood that the League of Nations didn't exactly work. So then they created a new thing called the United Nations, right? And then supposedly that was supposed to work, but at present there's about 150 wars going on all over the planet, so, you know, as long as I guess it doesn't concern the countries that were involved in World War I and World War II, I guess maybe they're happy, right? You know, so. The League had failed, and so were the United Nations, unless it recognized the true spiritual unity and equality of all living beings in terms of their intimate relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Abai did not expect any good to come from such organizations. Though they wanted peace and unity, their attempts were simply another feature of godlessness. Creating peace and unity was the duty of Vaishnavas, right? So he's saying is that they've tried, but it didn't work, right? So now what has to happen is people have to take up God consciousness. So actually creating world peace and unity, that's the duty of Vaishnavas. That's the duty of devotees. Because only they know the peace form. Only they know how the world actually functions. It's God's world. It functions under His laws. You follow those laws, then there'll be peace. You don't follow those laws, no peace. Right? Yes? No? Like that. Okay? So in here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai.